We'll pick up the countdown shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
It is June 4th, 2022, here in the Universal Time Zone, and I am coming to you with a pre-recorded show because I am attending Project A-Con, a Dallas-area anime convention, this weekend. The longest-running anime-themed fandom convention in North America, although, of course, it skipped last year. There are going to be a lot of asterisks in the record books, folks. As I have been doing for more than a decade, I'm putting on a classic anime festival program where I bring my Laserdisc player and play some selections that older fans may cherish and younger fans may be fascinated by. And my theme this year is Those Obnoxious Aliens. Because of the new Urusei Yatsura anime coming out, I'm playing some classic UI, and also some other things, such as Tenchi Muyo, and of course Project Eiko itself, in which people from other planets mess with Earth people. But now I want to talk about anti-humanism. Well, not so much want as feel compelled to, because it's not exactly a subject that I would like to touch, but I feel that I should. It seems to me there are two types of anti-humanism circulating in the world today. One of them, people call neoliberal capitalism or late capitalism, but it's not actually really much different from Stalinism. You're talking about a political economic structure which has, as an emergent property, goals which are completely unrelated to those of sane human beings. It treats human beings and their needs and their values as means to an end. Replaceable, disposable, and when not subserving that end, irrelevant. And I think most of us see the destructive effects and tendencies of this in the world around us. I inveigh against it enough, in one form or another, most of the time, that I think you're likely to agree I'm not being hypocritical if I take some time to talk about a second kind of anti-humanism, which often pops up as a position opposed to the first kind. This second type of anti-humanism is often rhetorically associated with degrowth and the rejection of human exceptionalism, a particular kind of anti-colonialism, and ethical veganism and Western converts to Buddhism. Now, I'm tarring with an extremely broad brush here, but where you see those things coming together, I think there's reason to tread carefully. Lest anyone should feel unfairly targeted, it was E.F. Schumacher of the British National Coal Board who used the term Buddhistic economics in his book Small is Beautiful, A Study of Economics as If People Mattered. I wouldn't presume to judge his ideas of Buddhism, but I will make the general observation that beliefs and practices often mean something somewhat different to the convert than they mean in the context of the communities and societies where they are widely held. This book inspired physicist and nuclear energy advocate Peter Beckman to publish a pamphlet entitled Economics as If Only Some People Mattered, which I don't have a copy of, but I suspect that much of what I have to say today mirrors his arguments, and elicited the comment from economist Kenneth Boulding, author of Beyond Economics. Paradoxically enough, it is the electricity produced by big power plants that makes the small beautiful. And what does Schumacher have to say about nuclear energy? He devotes a whole chapter to it, but here's a sample. What, after all, is the fouling of the air with smoke compared with the pollution of air, water, and soil with ionizing radiation? Not that I wish in any way to belittle the evils of conventional air and water pollution, but we must recognize dimensional differences when we encounter them. Radioactive pollution is an evil of an incomparably greater dimension than anything mankind has known before. One might even ask, what is the point of insisting on clean air if the air is laden with radioactive particles? And even if the air could be protected, what is the point of it if soil and water are being poisoned? and he invites us to reconsider the virtues of more familiar energy sources, which is almost pathologically nonsensical. Firstly, radioactivity and radiation are a part of the structure of the universe. They've always been with us. We cannot escape them no matter what we do with nuclear energy. And secondly, coal contains radioactive material. The burning of coal releases a great deal more radioactivity into the environment than civil nuclear energy activities. I might start by saying, why not human exceptionalism? Why should we as humans not consider humanity to be a thing of special value and to pay careful attention to the needs of human beings when making decisions? It seems to me, for example, a beaver may have some concept of its community and its surroundings, but not really of beavers as a species, or of the riparian ecosystem, or the way that that ecosystem interacts with other ecosystems. The result is that a community of beavers don't do environmental impact statements when they decide to build a dam. And if that dam causes serious adverse changes, either in their local environment or downstream somewhere, or even possibly upstream somewhere, well, that winds up being one of those things that is left to that messy and wasteful process, biological evolution, to sort out. Humans, on the other hand, are capable of considering the world system and the existence of a global optimum distinct from local optima. Will we? Now, that is a different question, but we are capable of doing it, and we have no particularly good evidence that any other beings on the Earth can or do. And from my point of view, that is good reason for treating humans differently. Now, the thing to observe about the advocates of degrowth is that they tend to present their position both as morally obligatory and as practically necessary. Now, I could argue all day about the first part, but it's when we look at the second part that we begin to be able, perhaps, to evaluate their arguments a bit more objectively. Now, why do they say that degrowth is a practical necessity? The answer is climate change and other ecological catastrophes. But here's the interesting thing. They don't stop at saying there are too many people at too high a level of material culture using too much of natural resources and producing too much of wastes and pollutants. They go beyond that. They say, once we abandon the idea of human exceptionalism, once we see ourselves as simply some animals, then we will feel a deep emotional connection to the Earth, which will stop us from doing things that result in the extinction of other animal species and large shifts in ecology. And it's on this basis that they put a high value on indigenous societies, which they say fit that model better than the modern, Western, technologically driven, racist, colonialist, sexist, whatever society. And it's when they say that that we start getting into evidentiarily testable propositions. Because by this point we have, from anthropology, paleontology, archaeology, some kind of picture of what our early ancestors, the Cro-Magnons or early modern humans, the Neanderthals, even to some extent the Denisovans, who remain somewhat obscure, what they actually did, how they actually behaved. And it becomes clear that our Paleolithic ancestors, who were presumably closer to the animal than we can ever hope to get, were not just hunting to extinction a few kinds of large animals, such as the cave bear or the ground sloth, with resultant major changes in the ecosystem. If you ever wondered, by the way, about the American horse apple, as it's known, the fruit of the bois d'arc tree, Bodark in the vernacular where I came from, it turns out that thing was meant to pass through the digestive tract of a giant sloth. And if you've ever seen the fruit I'm talking about, you now have a perfect understanding of it. But it also appears that they deliberately used fire on a very large scale to reshape landscapes. But I'm more interested in addressing this question of degrowth, because I think, again, that it's something that is not being presented honestly. Now, lest you should think that I am setting up straw men, or giving undue weight to fringe thinkers. And to be sure, in today's world it's easy to find people with all kinds of opinions. For example, feminists who say the human race should become extinct because pregnancy and childbearing constitute violence against women. Let me quote from a piece on the future of the university by Will Tulladar Douglas, who seems to be a leading degrowth thinker. We know that a rapidly deteriorating environment, where global heating, pollution, and collapsing biodiversity impose significant stresses on human societies, requires a complete reorientation of economics towards a managed degrowth model, and may well trigger economic collapse first. The present global service economy, with its energy-intensive patterns of shipping and travel, will be replaced by linked local economies and far more local systems of food production and manufacture. Hence, there will be more need for training in practical skills, that is to say, a greater need for schools rather than universities. Yet we will still need universities, and more than ever, they will need to be truly cosmopolitan, free of any external interference, and able to support students and researchers who have no other funding. This future university will need to respond to local needs. For example, actively contribute to the revitalization of endangered indigenous and local languages, ecosystems, and agroecologies, and at the same time weave its local community into a global network of scholarship and research. Given the catastrophic environmental and social damage that the dominant ideologies of the present have inspired, it is clear that among the values and practices that structure and inspire these communities must be radical ecocentrism, including an absolute rejection of human exceptionalism, egalitarian politics based in constant critical renewal of political representation, and a constant effort to seek out and empower the disenfranchised, a rejection of commodification and extraction as the basis for economics, a commitment to an economics that prizes the well-being of all living things above the accumulation of individual wealth, and an absolute rejection of xenophobia, colonialism, or protectionism of any kind. To be fair, these are only the most salient values that seem urgently required to me at the moment as we tumble into a crisis that may well extinguish humans as a species. Frankly, it sounds to me as though Professor Tulladar Douglas wants to cherry-pick the qualities he likes from high-energy societies and ascribe them to a hypothetical low-energy society, which he believes should be managed and directed, presumably by people very much like him. I will observe that this seems to me to set up the same basic problem as the Marxist-Leninist dictatorship of the proletariat, which turned out to be very dictatorial and not very proletarian. And it's not surprising to me that his ideal social institution for this managed degrowth world is based on the Buddhistic universities of South and Southeast Asia, which existed from perhaps the 3rd to the 13th centuries of the present era, concerning which we have extremely scanty information, which makes it very easy to construct any imaginary picture of what they were really like that you choose. In my opinion, degrowth may not work at all, starting from a global population of 7.5 billion people, which is where we are now. And even if it does work, I'm very much afraid that it permanently forecloses on any concept of social justice and is ultimately genocidal in its tendencies. Why do I say that? Well, firstly because the kinds of traditional societies which are idealized by the proponents of degrowth, as I've said before, tend to be extremely intellectually hidebound. They tend to be societies in which your life is predetermined by the conditions of your birth, and new ideas or divergent ways of thinking are sinful and not tolerated. Now, in practice, I think this is more a reason why it won't work than a reason not to do it, because you will have still enough people who just don't get with the program, people who are not committed enough to the ideals of degrowth that they will put up with this. Is the degrowth society going to allocate resources to providing clean drinking water and medical care to the children of the poor? Right, to the disadvantaged and marginalized societies, for whom degrowth advocates usually express extreme solicitude? Well, I don't see it. After all, providing them with those things will increase their survival rates and extend their lifespans, meaning that they will use more resources, which of course is anathema to the very concept of degrowth. Remember, please, that the growth in the human population in the past century and a half has not been due to higher birth rates. Birth rates have fallen the whole time. It's been due to greater survival rates and longer lifespans. Now, I'm not saying that the people advocating for degrowth are insincere or hypocritical, but I do not think that they have taken an honest look at what they are advocating. But, you say, the ecological catastrophes are real. What's our alternative? Well, the alternative is decoupling, or as it's sometimes termed, fully automated luxury gay space communism. I think people started calling it fully automated luxury communism, and then it just sort of snowballed from there. Decoupling is part of what I talk about with a high-technology, high-energy society, in which we use less and less land for agriculture because we use it more intensively, in which we draw less water from the lakes and the rivers because we're extracting the fresh water we need from the sea, and so on. That's decoupling. But my point is that we know, or at least we can have a very high degree of confidence, that decoupling will work, because it doesn't require, at least in its initial stages, anything that we're not already doing. Now, am I denying that we need social change? I've never denied that. What I've said is that social change takes time and is very dependent upon the material conditions, to lift a Marxist phrase. The kind of change that you're likely to get, and the direction in which it goes, in other words, have to grow out of the situation people are already in. And as I keep saying, if the direction of change you insist on is telling people who already have access to a high level of material culture that they have to give it up, and telling people who don't yet have access to it but can see it from here that they have to give up their aspirations, it's going to be a hard sell. And if you've abandoned the idea of decoupling, and you can't do degrowth, ecological catastrophe is the only possible outcome. And, you know, I can't say I don't get it, emotionally speaking. If you're convinced that the only two choices for humanity are, on the one hand, to become the all-devouring cosmic horror antagonist out of some video game, that strip mines entire solar systems or galaxies for their resources and then discards them, or, on the other hand, degrowth with all it implies, you're going to find a way to minimize in your own mind, and in the minds of the people you're speaking to, the genocidal and collapse-oriented aspects of that latter choice. And I know I've mentioned in passing before that it seems to me as though solarpunk, for all that it claims to be hopeful, is always kind of post-genocide oriented. That you can't really see a path from here to there that doesn't pass through some kind of event in which the poorer and less educated portion of the human race just mysteriously goes away. But I cherish great hope that is a false dichotomy. I believe that we can have the stars without becoming the devourers of worlds. I believe that the stars have lessons to teach us which we cannot learn until we are out there. That we will learn more about being human in the course of transcending planetary existence than we ever could learn so long as we remain here. Remember, it was only through space travel that people ever came to see the Earth as an integral whole. Decoupling turns out to mean choices which don't involve giving up quality of life. living in a fairly dense city, surrounded by parklands and croplands and wilderness reserves, instead of a low-density city surrounded by more low-density city, in the form of suburbs with single-family homes with lawns and belts of freeway and Amazon fulfillment warehouses and parking lots, which have an adverse effect on the drainage of rainwater. You can still have your 200 square meter house, but instead of being plopped down in the middle of a lawn, it's stacked with several others and abuts on several others in the form of a block. And instead of having the two-car garage, with its two cars that each cost a year's income, and cost a lot in fuel and upkeep, and just sit there most of the day not doing anything, you walk down to the street or take a lift down to street level, and typically get on a streetcar, or you get on your bicycle and ride, or in some cases, you call a taxi. And there are large green spaces set aside in the city for you to go and enjoy plantings that you don't have to maintain yourself. And if you do want to plant, there are allotment gardens set aside. And if you're not that ambitious, there's a roof garden on your block of flats, which is divvied up in some way by the Residence Corporation. And if you want to swim in a swimming pool, there are public baths and public pools. And this is a point that Georges Monbiot has made. Now, Monbiot is a columnist for The Guardian, and has always been sort of a voice of the environmental left who gets called things like Barking Moonbat, but he's also the guy whose response to Fukushima Daiichi was to publish an article saying, "I was wrong. Nuclear power is benign and we need more of it." I gotta respect him for that. And I gotta respect the editors of The Guardian for not dropping him like a hot potato when he did that. But Monbiot has made the point, and if you remember what I said about public libraries versus private book collections, that it's much easier to afford public luxuries than private luxuries. The economic and environmental costs of them are lower. So we actually have some hope, despite the effort that it would take of converting low-density automobile-oriented cities, such as Houston, Texas, into high-density, transit-oriented, pedestrian-oriented, let's drop that word pedestrian and simply say human-oriented cities, of the kind that I'm talking about. It rather looks as though the balance becomes favorable, so that it becomes easier to afford doing that not only in the wealthy countries, but also in the poorer countries. But all of this does imply social changes. The thing is, though, that the social changes it implies have already begun, and in many ways they've begun quite unpleasantly. So what we're talking about is not reversing changes that have already happened or starting a new trend. It's making the changes that are already happening more conformable to what people actually need, and at the same time, more environmentally acceptable. What am I talking about in this extremely abstract way? The concrete thing I am talking about is the slums of the megacities in the poor countries, where you have something resembling an urban core where people have electricity and running water, and then surrounding that, square kilometer after square kilometer of pit toilets and tar paper shacks and people who are getting their water from trucks. You know, here where I live, it's very common for the more well-to-do people to have private swimming pools, with the result that public swimming pools are very much neglected and many of them have been closed down because the more well-to-do people don't need them, they have their own pools. And the less well-to-do people, their voices don't count. Given the choice between the hassle and expense of maintaining a private swimming pool and the minor inconveniences of the public one, I would be on my bicycle, headed down to the public pool, before you could ask twice. Except that I can't. The public pool that was in easy striking distance when I moved here doesn't exist anymore. Now, I'm not saying that backyard swimming pools are the cause of homelessness in the USA and the destruction of the Amazonian rainforest, or whatever, but I do think that the triumph of private over public luxury has serious negative consequences that we can feel in our lives. As always, I look forward to receiving your cards and letters. Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you think I'm doing a good thing with these broadcasts, you can always send me some money. I do appreciate it. PayPal.me/Prometheus Lives. Thank you for listening to Anon Radio, and thank you to the SDF Public Access Unix System.
In the heart of our nation beats the pulse of our time, a monument to progress in the science of mankind, where Eisenhower's vision, like a keeper of the plains, stands watch on the horizon of Kansas fields of grain. Like the wolf that is its namesake, it's part of nature's blend. Like the people there who give it life with dedicated hands. It's Wolf Creek. It's Adams for Peace. It is teamwork and vision, and we proudly speak of this miracle that's not just concrete and steel, but the dreams of the strong will made real.